last-ditch measure of desperation that had been slapped together from spare parts, partly as a sign of defiance to the clan leadership who denied essential resources to the guards responsible for the base. There was no funding to install the planned anti-aircraft missile batteries, and no spare parts for one of the two AA Mazer turrets? Fine, the defenders had said. Screw the clan leadership. We can provide for our own defense. And so they did. The old truck was modified to carry an active sensor array, an energy shield generator on top at the front over the cab, a thick stack of heavy power cells, and on top in the back, a box containing six portable anti-aircraft missiles the humans called Zingers. The Zinger was designed to be carried by infantry, but was a versatile weapon that had been adapted for use by aircraft and even ground launch sites as sort of a cheap and short-range AA defense. Seconds after the truck's wheels ground to a halt just beyond the top of the ramp, the launcher pod rose up on its mount, swiveled, and fired three Zingers at the closest dropship.
"I'm going for the deck."
Irene pushed the Dodo's nose down in a power dive, knowing she was too close to outrun the short-range missiles. To her right, Derek was activating countermeasures to confuse the missile guidance systems, and the Dodo's defensive Mazer turrets began to engage targets. With power directed to the craft's energy shield and point defense Mazers, there was no energy available for the main Mazer cannons, and their missile bays were empty. Flying high cover above the base in her Vulture, Tutula had been frustrated and bored, irritated to be kept out of the action. She knew her part in the operation was vital, and still she chafed at being inactive. Even when defenders attacked the away team, she had been forced to hold fire because the other dropship was in the way. Now she had a threat she could engage, though her own missiles had all been expended. The last two missiles were loitering above the base, being held in reserve to deal with unexpected threats. With the other dropship fully busy fighting for its own survival, she retasked a pair of missiles onto the enemy truck, seeing them instantly shed their wings and streak down at full power. As she pulled her craft into a tight diving turn, she warmed up her Mazer cannons and began hammering the truck's energy shield. Irene dove straight away from the oncoming missiles, being careful not to make a turn that would cause the tail of the dropship to block a Mazer turret from line of sight to the missiles. The point defense Mazers were on automatic, and she had faith in their abilities based on her training and simulations, but the system was not perfect, and the pilot operating manual stated it worked best when the ship they were attached to flew straight and smooth. Yeah, she thought, try doing that when people are shooting at you. The Zinger was not a sophisticated opponent. Its warhead could only switch between direct impact and proximity kill modes, not having the capability to project its own Mazer beams and not containing submunitions or countermeasures to spoof defenses. Regardless, her trainers had emphasized that the Zinger could be a deadly threat to a dropship at low altitude. Even her small Dodo dropship was larger than a Boeing 777 and ungainly in an atmosphere. Fly, she told herself. Fly the ship and let Derek and the automated defenses do their jobs. She aimed for a gap between two tall warehouse-type buildings, beginning to reduce throttle and pull the nose up.
One down.
Derek's terse report was delivered in a strained voice befitting the occasion. A Mazer turret had scored a direct hit on a Zinger, getting lucky as the wildly jinking missile flew into the path of a beam. The missiles had popped up after launch and were now above them. He knew Irene was hoping ground clutter would confuse the missile's sensors, and he prayed she was right.
"Pulling up," Irene announced, having no choice unless she wanted to pancake the ship into the ground.
The maneuver worked as planned, between the countermeasures scrambling the Zinger sensors and ground clutter making the dropship hard to find, both of the enemy weapons temporarily lost target lock. One of them slowed and turned aside to get a wider angle perspective, its momentary straight flight making it an easy target for defensive Mazers that cooked off its warhead, sending shrapnel in every direction. The second missile never hesitated, as it had expected to receive sensor data from the missile that sacrificed itself. It did receive data from its own sensors, backscatter from the Mazer beam that pinpointed the location of the dropship inside its fuzzy stealth field. Instantly, the missile resolved the target from the ground clutter and adjusted course, deciding to detonate its warhead on proximity mode at the last second.
"We're hit," Irene grunted, as alarms blared and red lights flashed in the cockpit.
One engine began to tear itself apart.
She reached for the controls to eject it from its pylon, but Derek had already acted, and the craft jerked again with the sudden loss of weight as explosive bolts blew the pylon away from the wing. Irene almost lost control, the flight management system not wanting to do what she needed to do. Didn't the stupid computer see the warehouse they were about to crash into? Going to full power on the remaining engine, she rolled the ship to one side to avoid the starboard wing clipping a rooftop as they roared past. "More missiles inbound," Perkins warned. "Tutula, we could use some help here." Tutula was having her own problems. Both of the missiles she tasked to take out the truck had been intercepted and destroyed by Zingers launched in quick snapshot that she had to admire, and now the truck's missile launcher was swiveling upright to reload from the magazine below. Hits from her maser cannons only made the truck rock side to side. Its energy shield deflected the maser pulses aside to sear the ground around it. She needed to get closer so the energy of her maser beams was not weakened by passage through the atmosphere. She needed to get closer without being shot down, or she would be no use to anyone. "Coming," she acknowledged, and turned toward the other dropship that was wobbling and trailing smoke. Her only hope would be to draw attention of the missiles away from the crippled ship. Chapter 18. "They need our help. Coulter, you're with me," Sergeant Jates ordered as he flexed his powered legs and jumped upward out of the crater.
"What about me?"
Dave's own suit was flashing yellow warnings that the nanomotors and the legs were not operating at full capacity.
"You and Jarrett remain here."
Jates steadied Jesse as that soldier landed heavily from his own leap out of the crater.
"The transmitter must not be damaged, or this whole mission is for nothing."
"But..."
Dave began to protest.
"Dave, cover me,"
Shauna cut off the argument.
"I'm a sitting duck down here."
"Gotcha."
Dave readied his rifle and extended the sensor mast atop his helmet to pop up above the lip of the crater.
"Cornpone man. Vaya con Dios."
"Take care of my girl,"
Jesse answered without thinking.
Then there was no time for thought as he dashed after the Verdcris soldier.
Sergeant Jates had a simple plan. Hit the truck and hit it hard. He knew from the TacLink sensor feed what the truck looked like and where it was, and he also knew from experience that an energy shield was weakest where it contacted the ground. The shield was designed to protect from threats above. It could not be strong everywhere.
"Coulter, go right," he instructed as he came around a low building and caught a glimpse of the makeshift air defense vehicle.
As he turned to run straight at the truck, there was a loud whoosh sound accompanying the launch of two more missiles. Jake held his fire, knowing his maser beam and flechette rounds would only bounce off the shield and alert the enemy to his presence. When he was less than 30 meters from the target, a searing maser beam from above struck the shield, deflecting from the shield and blinding the sensors of Jates' suit for a long second. If he had been next to the truck when that beam struck, the backscatter would have boiled him alive, despite the best efforts of the skin suit to protect him. He crouched to his knees behind an elevated pipe, shaking his head and blinking to clear his own innate senses as the suit's systems cycled through a restart. It took less than 2 seconds, during which time he was blind and exposed and useless, hoping the soldiers in the truck had been similarly blinded and unaware of his approach. The sensors came back on abruptly, blinking a yellow warning about the outer layer of the suit's shell being scorched and recommending him to be careful.
"Be careful? In combat?"
He snorted in a bitter laugh at the Ruhar suit designers. Then he was up and racing forward, leaping over the pipeline and gaining speed. To his right, he saw Sergeant Coulter closer to the truck and guessed that human had been masked from the maser blast by the building. Jates used his superior speed to reach the truck just before Jesse, gesturing for Jesse to get on the ground and roll like the Verdcris did. As Jates hit the ground and rolled, his sensors went blind again, and he felt a fiery tingling like he was being bitten by thousands of poisonous ants. Then he was through the energy shield, and most of his sensors came back online. A quick glance upward revealed no Kristang looking down for threats on the ground. Jesse wriggled through the shield, coming to his knees and shaking his helmet before looking over to flash a thumbs-up gesture Jates had become familiar with. Jates pointed to the missile launcher box on the back of the truck above Jesse and spun to hop onto the truck frame behind the cab. Jesse did not need engraved instructions on what to do. He figured the situation called for blowing shit up and doing it right fucking now. His rifle was already selected for flechette rounds and armor-piercing mode. He held the weapon above his head to clear the big truck's frame rails and used the pop-up sensor mast of his helmet to get a clear view of the target. The Ruhar rifle did not have a full auto feature, so Jesse depressed the trigger button repeatedly to send 3-round bursts of flechettes into the swivel mount under the launcher box. The first 3 rounds penetrated the makeshift mount, locking it in place and skewing the box above. Subsequent rounds automatically switched themselves from armor-piercing to explosive mode based on sensor data from the suit's computer, and the tiny but powerful explosive-tipped flechettes ripped into the unarmored launcher box, tearing it apart like tissue paper and setting off the last 3 zingers. The truck rocked as the zinger motors were set off by the explosive energy, and the damaged missiles rocketed unguided out of their tubes to pinwheel across the sky. 1 zinger, so badly damaged to have its casing nearly cracked in half, broke apart while still in the launch tube. What remained of the launcher box was shredded, and then the missile's warhead exploded after it had thudded into the ground no more than 20 meters from the truck. The explosion knocked Jesse off his feet and sent him skidding across the ground past the front of the truck, his boots clipping a wheel along the way. Jesse spun as he slid across the dusty ground, one arm firmly gripping the rifle, while the other flailing to halt his uncontrolled skid. The rifle was torn from his grip, and his helmet bashed into something hard. Jesse slumped in his suit as he rolled to a stop, blinking, and seeing only stars in his vision. Sergeant Jates cursed words that could not be properly translated. He had been about to fire rounds into the truck's lightly armored cab when the explosion knocked him off his feet, and he had fallen heavily to the ground on top of his rifle, cracking the casing of the weapon's control system. He tossed it away in disgust and extracted a sidearm as the truck's cab door creaked open and the muzzle of a Kristang rifle poked out, mercifully at a bad angle to target Jates. The Sergeant grasped the door with one glove and reached around to pump shots into the cab with his sidearm, emptying the weapon's 16-shot magazine, then tossing the spent pistol away to grasp the dead Kristang's rifle and haul it out of the cab. He no sooner held the rifle stock when it was shot out of his hands, the rounds coming from inside the cab. Reacting, he reached back for a grenade on his belt and tossed it into the cab, slamming the door closed and using his weight to hold it there until the grenade detonated and the door came flying off, Jates with it. He lay momentarily stunned on the ground before popping to his feet in a smoothly gymnastic move assisted by the skin suit's stabilizers, the top of his helmet crashing into something unseen and making him fall again. When he was able to roll onto one side, he saw a figure in Kristang hard armor facing him and holding its helmet with both hands, just as stunned as Jates. The rifle the figure had about to use to shoot Jates had gone flying away beyond reach, but farther from Jates. For a split second, both soldiers looked at the lost rifle, then each other, both judging they did not have the time to dive for the weapon. The Kristang reached behind his back for some type of weapon, so Jates did the only thing he could do. He launched himself through the air to tackle his opponent before the man armed himself. Too late. A pistol came around toward Jates, who survived only by ducking his head and using the top of his helmet to smash the other under the chin. The blow made them separate, and the pistol soared up onto the truck that was still rocking from many explosions. The Kristang howled, and an evil-looking knife appeared in one hand, having slid down from a sheath on his forearm. Holding the knife for slashing rather than stabbing, he held his other arm out wide and stepped sideways to trap Jates against the truck, so Jates responded by racing inside the man's guard and wrapping him in a crushing bear hug. The knife came down into Jates's back, where it snapped and slid away, just as the Verdcris had known it would, the skin suit having stiffened and produced a slippery hump in the area where the knife was projected to impact.
"Ruhar, weakling scum!"
the enemy soldier screamed, spittle flinging onto the side of his faceplate to drop down against the repulsor field. As they struggled, the enemy to break away and Jates to gain a grip on a weak area of his opponent, Jates eye-clicked his faceplate to go clear, and he was rewarded by a gasp and brief hesitation by the other man.
"I am no Ruhar," Jates grunted,
using the all-too-brief moment of surprise to get both hands firmly around the other man's left arm.
I am true, Kristang. Liar! Traitor!
The opponent screamed, and used the full power of his hard-shell armor in a futile attempt to break free of the crushing grip exerted by the Ruhar skin suit's gloves.
You are the traitor to our heritage.
Jaitz's words came out in a bubbling gasp as the two spun around and slammed each other repeatedly against the truck.
You are slaves to the Ruhar.
We are all slaves. My masters have better technology.
Jaitz butted a shoulder under the man's chin, then pressed a knee on his chest, ordering his skin suit to exceed its safety limits. The two powered armor suits strained and whined, warning lights flashing in each visor, until Jaitz gave a mighty jerk backward, and the enemy's left arm tore away at the weak shoulder joint in the armor, taking the flesh and bone limb with it. The soldier slumped backward as blood spurted out only briefly, before a seal formed over the wound. Nanomachines injected into the man's spine kept him from going into shock. He actually tried to stand and face Jaitz defiantly. The Verdgris soldier viciously swung the torn armor limb like a club straight into his injured opponent's faceplate. Once, twice, three times, until the man went limp on the ground, and Jaitz finished him by stomping hard on the neck joint of the suit, snapping the bones beneath.
Holy shit!
Jesse was on one knee, his rifle barrel wavering as his vision had not cleared completely.
I couldn't get a clean shot, he explained.
It is finished.
Jaitz wriggled inside the skin suit, his real limbs and joints aching terribly from the strain. When the armored limb tore loose, his skin suit was using so much power, it almost popped Jaitz's shoulders out of their sockets.
You done torn his arm off and beat him to death with it.
Jesse's pupils were as big as they could get.
I mean, damn, I heard people say that before, but I never seen anybody do it.
Ignoring the human's comment, Jaitz turned away so he wouldn't show the pain on his face. He feared he had torn muscles, and I clicked to damp down the painkillers the suit was injecting into him. He couldn't afford the brain fuzziness that the painkillers sometimes caused.
My rifle is broken, he explained as he picked up the Kristang weapon.
Yeah.
Jesse carefully poked his head around the missing door to see the bloody carnage in the truck's cab. What was left of the missile launcher box had stopped shaking from explosions, and the flickering haze of the energy shield was gone, a fact Jesse verified by looking up at the shield projector dome above the cab. The dome was peppered by shrapnel, and sparks arced inside it.
Maybe we should get away from here, in case this thing's power cells blow.
Good,
Jaitz gasped, falling to his knees.
Idea.
Hey, man. Sergen, you okay?
I could.
Jaitz swallowed his pride.
Use assistance.
Yeah, sure thing.
Jesse knew how much that admission must have cost the proud warrior.
Up you go,
he said, not knowing what else to say. Jaitz put an arm around Jesse's shoulders, and Jesse carefully stood up to his full height. Then they took slow steps forward.
I feel like I got hit by that truck, Jaitz groaned.
If it makes you feel any better.
The after-effect of combat making Jesse's accent thicker than molasses in January, as his grandpappy would say.
The other guy looks a lot worse.
He eye-clicked to open the tack link as they shuffled away from the truck quickly as possible.
Colonel Perkins, that truck is out of action, you copy?
Colonel.
He shared a frightened look with Jaitz.
Colonel. Anyone.
Irene had her full concentration simply on not crashing, as the big and awkward Dodo zoomed sickeningly between and just above buildings. One engine had been ejected by blowing explosive bolts where its pylon connected to the hull. The other engine was severely overheated. The rear control surfaces were sluggish from battle damage. The aft point defense maser turret was still rebooting, and they had an unknown number of missiles on their tail, none of which Irene could pay attention to at the moment. She had to focus on the most basic rule of aviation. Fly the aircraft. Everything else could and would have to wait, or be handled by someone else, until Irene could get the dropship flying steady and not wobbling as if about to auger into the ground at any second. The asymmetric thrust from the one remaining engine was trying to flip the clumsy craft on its back. Derek forced himself to tear his eyes away from the cockpit display windows to ignore the sight of the ground that was right there as the dropship skidded across the sky tilted on its side. He poured emergency coolant into the overheated engine, wasting hours of precious coolant in seconds and wishing the controls didn't keep warning him of the totally obvious dangers.
"Yes, I know we are missing an engine. Thank you very much, you piece of shit."
The missile threat warning hooting annoyingly in his ear was also unnecessary.
"Okay, okay, okay."
Irene felt her stomach muscles unclench painfully as the big dropship steadied at a 12-degree angle to the port side, and she was able to gain altitude in a controlled manner.
"Not okay!"
Derek couldn't wait any longer for the bulky topside aft maser turret to make up its mind and finish rebooting. The damn thing was stuck somewhere in its cycle. He guessed some physical component had been damaged and the point defense system was waiting for a reply that would never happen.
"Yaw starboard 30 degrees, then roll us another 10 degrees to port."
Without asking why, Irene gently slewed the ship 30 degrees to the right without banking, in a cringe-inducingly un-aerodynamic maneuver. When the ship's nose was pointed in the designated direction, she rolled it even more to the left and held the course straight.
"Doing it."
Why?
"Topside aft PDS is offline. We need the belly cannon tracking inbounds," Derek responded without looking up from his console. "Belly PDS has targets."
The maser turret on the underside of the ship reacted immediately when the bulk of the craft was no longer masking its line of sight to the four inbound missiles. The maser exciters got photons lined up coherently, and pulses of microwave energy lanced out in coordination with the forward topside turret, bracketing the closest missile and getting closer with each shot. With two masers working together quicker than the blink of an eye, the random side-to-side and up-and-down evasive jinking of the missile had to become less random to avoid running into a destructive beam. In less than a quarter second, the dropship's point defense system identified a pattern in the missile's attempts to evade being effectively targeted, and the next shot from the topside cannon was aimed slightly to the right and below the missile. The lead missile flew directly into the beam, and its warhead exploded. Having one less missile tracking them was great for the three humans and one Jirapha inside the dropship. The premature detonation of the warhead meant no shrapnel could catch the accelerating craft, and its PDS automatically switched focus to the second missile, and was confused for a crucial 0.4 of a second. The downside to the first missile exploding was that the Kristang weapons designers were not stupid, nor were they inexperienced at air combat. When the missile was hit by a maser beam, its tiny brain had a nanosecond to assess whether the hit was fatal, and the answer was yes, and then hell yes, as the propulsion motor began to break up from the maser energy. The second question was whether the missile was close enough to try for a proximity kill, and the answer was sadly, no. So the missile's last act of defiance was to detonate its warhead in chaff mode, the explosive charge in a wide disc parallel to its direction of flight. Burning hot particles created a cloud that scorched the air, filled the area with powerful static, and temporarily blocked the dropship's view of the second missile. The second missile also was smart. It knew what the first missile had done and why, and even before it decrypted the final burst transmission from the doomed weapon, the second missile fired thrusters to slow itself and linger in the shadow of the cloud another hundredth of a second before turning violently to the left and down. The second missile also had analyzed the target's defensive capability and tendencies and identified what it hoped was a weakness, so it intended to approach from a direction where only one maser turret could get a line-of-sight view. Derek recognized the danger even before the red light flashed on his console.
"We lost target lock. We lost it."
The predictive software was warning the missile would impact in 3 seconds or less, and the point defense system still was searching the sky for that second missile. The display held 3 fuzzy pink objects that might be possible threats, with confidence too low for the PD cannons to fire. Even as Derek's brain formed the thought, "To hell with that," and his fingers reached to override the PDS safeties so the damned maser turrets could fire at something, he knew anything he did would be too late.
"Is there..."
Irene asked to inquire if there was something she should be doing, could be doing, when the Dodo rocked and even more warning lights flared on the consoles. They had been struck from behind. Thank God it was a proximity blast and not a direct hit. The aft belly turret was offline, and most systems behind the 17th structural frame were glitching, dead, or dead and on fire. That wasn't right. Zingers could shape their proximity warheads to direct the shrapnel in a cone toward the target. There should be a lot more damage. The tail should be shredded.
You hit the...
Thank you to Tula, Derek interrupted the pilot.
Welcome, the Verdcris woman replied tersely, having no time to chat as she flipped her relatively nimble fighter gunship into a tight turn. Normally, bleeding off airspeed in combat is a surefire recipe for disaster, but she had no choice. With the other dropship missing an engine, trailing fire as random parts broke away and unable to defend itself unless its two forward point defense turrets got lucky, she had to cover it with her own cannons, and that meant flying slow and close. The idea of flying straight at the missiles and trying to shoot them with her more powerful but slow-reacting maser cannons was an idiotic scheme that would have washed her out of flight training before she could get herself killed. Being smart meant tucking her ship in behind the crippled dropship, trying to anticipate its movements, and trusting her Vulture's point defense system to do its job. Her fighter had energy shields, but in flight they were useful only against directed energy weapons like maser and particle beams. Against missiles, unless she got very lucky by spoofing the enemy guidance systems at long range, it was kill or be killed, and even her enhanced reactions were far too slow to track an incoming missile. A glance at the point defense system monitor showed it was fully capable and ready for more action after having destroyed the second missile before it could hit Perkins's ship. Now it was a matter of one computer system matching against another. The missiles had the advantage of being small, stealthy, and ferociously maneuverable, and of tracking a large and slow-moving target. The dropship's maser cannons had the advantage of a stable platform to shoot from, their beams traveling at the speed of light and being able to cycle a kill shot every 3/10 of a second. Tutula hated relying on the cold logic of automated systems for her survival. The two remaining missiles in flight had no discomfort about relying on logic, as they had not been programmed to experience comfort, discomfort, or any other emotions. They had been expertly programmed to kill and to use cold, hard logic to accomplish that. Both missiles analyzed the situation, and when one missile made a suggestion that would require the sacrifice of the other, the suicidal missile did not hesitate. Instantly, the two separated, with one missile continuing to track the smaller target and jink toward it to evade maser fire, while the other missile dove down and went wide to kill the crippled target. The snap assessment had been that their best chance to make a kill was to hit the crippled ship rather than the nimble fighter gunship. If the suicidal missile could hit the fighter airspace craft, that would be great, but its purpose was to draw defensive fire away from its companion. The suicidal missile's brain recorded a maser beam near miss that was too close, and it calculated a 76% chance a maser would score a direct hit before it got close enough for even a proximity kill. So without any regret, it detonated its warhead in a shape charge directed at the fighter craft ahead of it. Tutula had no time for rejoicing, and no cause for celebration when the warhead blew by itself. Her fighter was caught in the shockwave and shrapnel pinged off the hull, making the defensive shield flare and fuzzing the view of the point defense sensors. The system attempted to lock on to the single remaining missile, cycling through several engagement solutions in nanoseconds, before concluding it could not be confident of an intercept before the missile struck the crippled Dodo dropship. It signaled that bad news to the pilot by flashing an orange light on a console. When Tutula saw the blinking light representing the depressing analysis of her point defense system, she did not shout out a useless warning. The missile was approaching from below and behind the other dropship, the vulnerable Dodo carrying the mission commander and the Giraptha who was needed to extract data from the research core. The data that was needed to save the lives of humans on the planet they called Paradise, and more importantly, to safeguard the lives of Ruhar on that planet and beyond. Saving lives was why she dedicated her life toward training hard to qualify for star duty. Saving lives was really only a secondary objective, but at the moment, saving the lives aboard the other dropship aligned perfectly with her primary mission. Tutula kicked the throttles to maximum and pushed the nose down, straight into the path of the missile. If the missile was startled by the good fortune of scoring a direct impact on a fighter gunship rather than an already damaged target, it made no comment as it altered course slightly. At that angle, it could not have hit the larger dropship anyway. So it pushed through the Vulture's ineffective energy shield, plunging through the lightly armored skin above the portside wing and shattering a maser cannon before it struck something solid enough to set off its warhead.
Holy shit, Derek gulped, his throat constricting, so he choked on the words. Get us out of here. On the deck.
Missile status? Perkins asked as Irene dipped the nose and built up airspeed, confused by what her tactical display was showing her.
No birds in the air, Derek reported with an anguished look shared between the pilots.
We got it? Perkins asked with a shudder of relief, unaware she had been holding her breath.
No, ma'am.
Irene responded for Derek, who was too badly shaken and focusing his attention on keeping their one engine running.
Tutula flew right into the path of that last missile. She saved us, ma'am.
I didn't... Perkins blinked away tears that suddenly formed, angry at herself for weakness in combat and for not understanding what the Verdcris pilot had done.
Can we...
She was interrupted by a call over the tack link.
Colonel Perkins, that truck is out of action, you copy? Colonel, anyone?
The interruption brought her back to focus. She could mourn later.
Sergeant Coulter, what is your status?
We busted that truck up good.
Jesse's thick accent had toned down a bit as his heart rate slowed.
Shauna and Dave are guarding the sensor transmitter. We're okay down here. Sergeant Jates took a pounding.
I am fully effective. Jates protested. Colonel Perkins, I suggest my team search the base for opposition before you land. Can you provide air support?
Negative on the air support.
Perkins did not elaborate.
Jates, secure the transmitter ASAP and clear the area around the research compound. We can land between buildings there.
If Jates had a bad feeling about why no air support was available, he did not say anything. The ground team first sprayed a fast-setting foam around the transmitter, then partly filled in the crater to bury it, placing the ceramic block on top. The four then rushed over to the research base and cleared the compound building by building as quickly as they could, a task simplified by the fact the research section only contained three buildings. When Jates gave the all-clear, the big dropship came in low from the north, tucking itself between two buildings and awkwardly set down in a choking cloud of dust. The back ramp was already open, Arlen Dahl stepping nimbly out on his four legs as the craft settled on its landing skids. Perkins was right behind the Giraptha.
Sergeant Jates,
I already know, he replied stiffly.
I'm sorry. She sacrificed herself to save us, to save the lives on Paradise.
Excuse me, Colonel Perkins, but that is not why Tutula acted, not why I am here. We serve the Ruhar to save our own people from slavery, to rescue our culture from extinction. I think in that way, my people and yours have something very important in common. To the surprise of Emily Perkins, the hulking alien in the dirty and scratched skin suit offered her a fist bump. While that was not proper military protocol, it was a heartfelt gesture, and she graciously accepted.
Sergeant Jates, can you escort Arlen Dahl to the research corps?
Jarrett, go with them, she added without waiting for Jates to reply.
Chaika, Coulter, go see what those asshole keepers are doing. I don't want any interference from them.
Chapter 19 Dave jogged warily over to where the control group of humans was being kept, with Jates and Dahl down in the bunker to access the research lab's computers, and Shauna providing cover for the Giraptha. Perkins had ordered Dave and Jesse to check out the ruined and smoking dropship hangar to assure there weren't any more surprises waiting for the assault team, then to make contact with the keepers. Secretly, he had been hoping that entire group of assholes had been killed during the attack so they wouldn't be his problem. But no such luck.
The control group was being held in a fenced area separated from the rest of the base by a wide, flat, open stretch of ground, and as he ran across it, Dave saw the open ground had been bulldozed flat. The Kristang had created a killing ground between their base and where the keepers were kept. That told him just how much the keepers were valued and trusted.
Jesse, man, check it out.
Dave pointed with his rifle as he approached the fence.
That's some serious security.
The keepers were surrounded not only by a fence with clouds of razor wire on top. The fence was a double layer with a spike-filled trench separating the fences by 4 meters. Jesse halted, bent down to pick up a stone, and tossed it at the outer fence. There was a shower of sparks, and the stone was thrown back.
That fence must have an independent power source. Hell, we need to turn that off.
The only way in was a road that spanned the trench, with gates in the fence. Inside the fence, keepers were peeking out from the side of the 3 buildings in the center, presumably where the control group lived. One of the buildings was nothing more than a prefab metal hut for storing something. The other 2 had windows with people's faces visible. With them wearing Ruhar skin suits and their helmets on, there was no way for the keepers to know the base had not been assaulted by Ruhar. Even Sergen Jaitz wore Ruhar flexible armor, so there was no way to see he was Kristang. And clearly, their dropship was a Ruhar craft.
I don't know how to turn off the electricity, but I do know how to open these gates.
Dave flicked off his rifle safety, took aim, and fired a maser beam at the top hinge of the outer gate. Jesse joined him, working on the lower hinge, and soon the gate sagged and crashed to the ground. Dave sliced away power cables and kicked a stone at the gate with his boot. The stone clattered and bounced off the gate, but there were no sparks. Being careful not to touch the live fence on either side, they dragged the gate out of the way and repeated the procedure with the inner gate, kicking it inside the compound with their power-assisted legs.
"Come on out, y'all," Jesse called out, irritated with the keepers for hanging back.
Didn't those dumbasses know that if the attackers wanted them dead, the dropship could have strafed the compound and killed every one of them?
"Come out, you bunch of cowards!"
At one side of a barracks, there was an animated conversation, with raised voices and a scuffle. One of the people broke free and ran toward the 2 suited figures, then stopped, looked behind himself, and continued walking forward slowly. 6 other people hurried forward and caught up to him. One put a hand on the lead guy's shoulder, but he shook it off. Most of the keepers were wearing baseball caps and bush hats against the bright morning sunlight, with others protecting their heads with rags wrapped around their skulls. All of them were dressed in relatively new, if dirty, clothing. The hats still had visible UNEF logos, although most of the logos had been defaced in some way. Dave and Jesse looked at each other. Where had the keepers gotten new gear? The last time either of them saw a UNEF baseball cap, the blue material had faded to a light gray. And boots. All the keepers were wearing nice boots that hadn't been patched and mended 6 times.
"Hello,"
the lead guy spoke, holding up one hand and taking his cap off with the other.
"What the f—"
"Eric," Jesse exclaimed.
"Jesus," Dave gasped, astonished.
"Eric Koblenz?"
The guy shaded his eyes but could not see the faces inside the opaque helmets. Dave and Jesse ordered their faceplates to go clear, and Eric's eyes bulged.
"Ski? Cornpone?
What the hell?
What? How are you here?" he sputtered.
"That's Dave and Jesse to you, asshole,"
Dave growled. Even at tiny Fort Rakovsky, they had not liked that jerk referring to them by nicknames.
"Hell, you call us Sergeants Coulter and Chaika,"
Jesse corrected his friend, and tapped the U.S. Army chevron and rocker symbol on his shoulders.
"Sergeants?"
Eric looked closer and saw the familiar rank symbols. He should have noticed that right away. Those were not Ruhar insignia.
"What are you doing here? In hamster armor?"
"We'll ask the questions here," Dave snapped. "We're part of a Ruhar task force now," he fibbed.
Before he could brag like he greatly wanted to, Eric interrupted.
"Guys, please. You have to get me out of here. Please."
His eyes were pleading, his hands held out in supplication.
"The lizards lied to us. I think they used us for medical experiments. We were..."
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock, Jesse cut him off. Y'all were brought here as guinea pigs. The lizards made a bioweapon to use against our people on Paradise, and you all were part of it.
We didn't know, Eric protested.
They only told us.
Don't listen to their lies,
a man behind Eric growled as he reached out to pull the now reluctant keeper backwards. But Eric was not going for that shit. Not anymore. His elbow shot back and cracked the man in the face, breaking his nose and sending a spray of blood to splatter Eric. Two others stepped in, though hesitantly and without enthusiasm. Eric punched one of them, and they backed off, holding up their hands to signal they were not participating in this fight. Then Eric went crazy. The man whose nose he had broken was on the ground, rolling to his feet, when a savage kick to the ribs from Eric's boot knocked him back down. Seeing a red haze of anger in his vision, Eric Koblenz kicked the man over and over.
Don't you ever touch me again, you son of a bitch. I'm sick. Sick of your goddamn lies. Jesus!
He aimed a particularly savage kick at the man's bloody face.
You made me betray my friends, you fucking piece of shit!
Whoa. Whoa, settle down there, Koblenz. Jesse surprised himself by stepping forward and restraining the enraged former soldier. For a second, Jesse thought Eric would lash out at him, but the man collapsed to his knees, sobbing.
Ski.
Jesse had no idea what to do.
A little help here?
Dave gestured with his rifle to move the others back. He half-turned his back on the injured man who was lying prone, but the enhanced peripheral vision of his helmet alerted him to danger when the bloodied man pulled a fabric-wrapped shiv from a pocket and lunged at Eric. Reflexively, Dave shot the would-be assailant in the gut with a maser beam, his powered suit legs lifting him up and backwards clear of the man's reach.
Holy sh-!
Jesse pulled Eric out of the way, his power-assisted arm sending Eric rolling across the dusty ground. Harder than he intended, Jesse stomped on the assailant's knife hand, hearing and feeling bones crunch.
Ugh!
The would-be assailant groaned.
Shit, that hurts, you goddamn hamster lover!
You gonna settle down and cooperate? Jesse asked with his rifle muzzle pointed straight at the asshole's broken nose.
Fuck you, traitor.
The man spat blood on Jesse's legs.
Eh, wrong answer.
Jesse squeezed the trigger, having selected the undermounted railgun. An explosive-tipped flechette dart sped out, not having time to deploy its guidance fins before burying itself in the man's skull and exploding. Jesse wiped blood and gore off his helmet, kicking the headless body away in disgust. He turned to the shocked faces of the crowd that had assembled around them.
Anybody else got smart-ass remarks you won't try on me?
No?
Because this counter...
He turned the rifle so the crowd could see the display on top of his rifle.
Says I got 19 more explosive darts in the magazine, plus like 100 maser shots left in the power cell.
Coulter. Chaika. Perkins's voice came over their helmet speakers. I heard weapons fire. You both okay?
We're fine, Colonel, Dave replied. We got some keepers here who are having second thoughts about their loyalty to the lizards.
They giving you trouble?
No, ma'am. It's the idiots who are not having second thoughts who are causing a ruckus. There's one less of them now.
Understood. Chaika, be careful, especially of the ones who want out. This will be the second time they've changed sides. They might be looking for a convenient opportunity to flip loyalties again.
Copy that. Colonel, one of the guys who regrets coming here is a guy Jesse and I knew way back from our farm village in Lemuria. What are the odds, right?
You trust him?
Not as far as I could throw him,
Dave snorted, then remembered he was wearing an advanced technology power-assisted skin suit.
I throw him on my own, I mean. He was an asshole back then, but Jesse and I think this guy joined the Keepers because he was stupid and he listened to the wrong people.
Be careful anyway.
I think the headless horseman here...
Dave looked down so Perkins could see the shattered body through his helmet camera.
Is discouraging any moron to a feeling adventurous.
Ma'am, Jesse called out, jogging out of the keeper compound, waving something in one hand.
Colonel, look, they've got UNEF ration packs. Lots of them. There's a whole building full of human food and uniforms and all kinds of UNEF stuff inside the fence where that control group is living.
MREs? Perkins caught the package Jesse tossed to her. Beef stroganoff?
beef. She had not eaten beef, real beef, in years. The cultured, lab-grown beef substitute provided by the Ruhar as an experiment was tasty, if a bit bland, and still in short supply.
Huh. She read the label. This is still good. It hasn't expired yet.
I don't know if it was good when it was fresh, ma'am, but they've got crates of MREs and other rations in one of the buildings here. He jerked a thumb over one shoulder behind him.
Dave was back making sure the keepers didn't do anything stupid, to the Mavericks or to themselves, while Jesse reported to Perkins.
Goddamn lizards were holding out on us, and the dumb keepers here were eating like kings compared to us on Paradise. Hell, I half-starved on corn and taters in Lemuria, and the lizards probably had warehouses, entire starships full of supplies.
When the hamsters took Paradise back, whatever human food the Kristang were shipping to Paradise might have gotten dumped here, Perkins speculated.
Jesse shook his head once angrily. No way. We stopped getting supplies from Earth before the hamsters took the planet back. That's why Bishop had the cushy job of planting potatoes, remember?
Perkins did remember that time, but her memories were different. We were still getting supplies shipped in from home back then, at a lower rate but steady. HQ slow-rolled distribution to the field because they wanted to build up a stockpile to get us through lean times.
HQ was holding out on us?
They weren't holding out, Coulter. The lizards had warned us we needed to become self-sufficient. They were tired of footing the bill for shipping everything we needed all the way from Earth. Even before the Ruhar arrived to retake the planet, the lizards told us the Force would not be going straight back to Earth, even after we got the last hamster off the planet. Our guess back then was the White Wind Clan planned to pimp us out again to another clan.
Another evac op?
No. Perkins wanted to spit, but couldn't inside her sealed-up helmet. HQ figured we most likely would be used as cannon fodder in battles between clans.
Oh, hell. Damn. So we got lucky when the hamster fleet showed up. Can we bring ration packs back with us?
Perkins looked at the dropship, sitting with its back ramp open.
Any supplies we take from here may be contaminated, but we'll need to scrub the inside of the dropship anyway before we can take these suits off.
All right, Coulter. There's plenty of space and storage lockers aboard the dropship. Cram in whatever you can fit. And do us a favor. If you see any Chinese ration packs that are labeled something like pickled herring, leave them and take something else.
I can't read Chinese.
Jesse wasn't sure if his CO was joking or not.
Perkins tapped her visor.
Your helmet translator can.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Jesse's face turned red inside his helmet.
Take Jarrett with you. She told me she's not being much help to Jates, and he doesn't need anyone to cover him. That research bunker is empty.
Yes, ma'am.
Shauna, come on up here. We got work to do. It's dinner time.
We have trouble,
Jates shouted while running out of the underground bunker, waving a tablet at Perkins.
What, a ship jumped in?
She shuddered as a jolt of fear ran up her spine. Her body was just coming down off the adrenaline high of combat. Now she felt her heart racing again. Although her mind flashed, why? If an enemy ship was now above them, there was absolutely nothing she could do about it.
No. Worse.
Worse? What the hell could be?
Jates cut her off.
Dahl just found out this base is programmed to self-destruct. The crew must have activated that sequence before the last one of them died.
Okay. Shit.
She glanced quickly around. They had one dropship, no motorized vehicles, and no spare skin suits that could speed a person's escape.
Did you get the data we need?
Jake held up something that looked like a shiny metallic sphere the size of a softball.
This is the memory core. Dahl says we can access it through dropship computers. Colonel, we have the keys to decrypt the data, but there were not any samples of the pathogen in the research lab. The researchers took everything with them. Or they destroyed all their samples before they left.
Damn it. Could we, or the Ruhar, synthesize the pathogen from the data you retrieved?
I do not know. We will need to decrypt all the data first. Colonel, I do know we must leave here immediately.
We need to get these idiot keepers moving, then. They can head toward...
Colonel Perkins, there is no time for anyone to walk out to a safe distance. Under the base is a multi-megaton atomic compression device. It must have been provided by the Theranon, or possibly the Bosphorok. The warrior caste wishes to erase all signs of their illegal activity here.
A nuke? That's against the rules.
She meant the rules of engagement enforced by the two senior species and the endless war, rules intended to prevent lesser beings from contaminating life-sustaining biospheres. Biological warfare is also a violation of the rules, but that pathogen will be used against a populated world with a healthy biosphere. Technically, atomic compression devices are not considered nukes because they do not create long-lasting radioactive fallout. Colonel, regarding the rules, setting off a single nuclear device here would probably not provoke a reaction, because one such weapon would not significantly damage a world that is already doomed. The variable star will render this planet uninhabitable within the next 3,000 years.
Oh, hell. How big an explosion and how much time do we have?
Scratch that. Is there any way we can shut it down? No, to your final question. The device is buried in a hardened canister, and any unauthorized attempt to access the canister will cause immediate detonation. The self-destruct mechanism is simple and rugged. Dahl says he does not know any way to hack into it. Once the mechanism was activated, it cuts itself off from further instructions.
God damn it!
To answer your other question, the device is powerful enough to obliterate everything in this valley. We need to be behind that ridge. He pointed to the mountain peaks that rimmed the bowl-shaped valley. When the device explodes and... He checked his tablet. 12 minutes and 49 seconds.
Strebitch!
Perkins roared and twirled one finger over her head in a spin-up motion the former Blackhawk pilot knew well.
We are leaving!
Except they couldn't.
Ma'am.
Irene's hands shook from emotion as she explained the problem in a whisper.
We can't take all these people with us. They won't all fit. And with the ship carrying that much mass...
She shot a fearful look at the lowest point of the surrounding ridge.
We won't clear the ridge. I'm sorry. We only have one engine to provide power. We can't take all these people.
Her eyes darted to the cluster of keepers who had been herded together.
Strebitch, we are not leaving any humans to die here, you got that? Strip this thing of anything you can toss out the door fast, and we will make room.
Colonel, Derek pled his case. She's right. There simply is not enough space inside the cabin for all these people. He hoped their commanding officer did not make a foolish request like strapping people to the dodo's stubby wings. If we stack people in on top of each other, we can... He ran a quick estimate in his head. Fit most of them. We would still be leaving a dozen or more. The cabin. Perkins appraised the dropship's cramped interior, designed to hold only 14 troops.
Wait, your Winchester on missiles?
Yes, we launched our full weapons load in the raid. Derek answered warily.
Can we put people in the missile bays if they use oxygen masks?
I wouldn't recommend that, Derek replied as he shared an alarmed look with Irene.
Screw the recommendation. Can we do it?
We can try, Irene agreed quickly, hoping to end the discussion before Perkins thought up an even worse idea.
Jarrett, Coulter, Chaika, we need to strip out the cabin seats now.
They got 5 very frightened people stuffed into each of the 2 empty missile bays, but the simple expedient of explaining their choice was a few minutes of discomfort or dying in a nuclear fireball. 3 keepers still refused the evac orders, protesting that they remained loyal to the Kristang and would not cooperate with their supposed rescuers. Perkins ended that rebellion with a rifle butt to the face of one protester, ordering his unconscious form dropped unceremoniously on the bottom of the pile in the cabin.
Seriously?
Shauna cocked her head at one still protesting asshole.
I would be more than happy to shoot you right now.
There is no nuke, the asshole spat at her. Unless you planted it to cover evidence of your attack on our allies, you traitorous bitch.
7 minutes, Irene screamed through the dropship's doorway. We need to go now.
Bitch. Shauna's grip tightened on her rifle.
You might...
The argument ended abruptly when Jesse casually shot a maser beam through the protester's right thigh. Then, when the keeper slumped to the ground, kicked him hard under the chin.
Grab an arm. We'll drag Sleeping Beauty here into the ship, he ordered, and began pulling the unconscious asshole up the ramp, which was beginning to cycle closed.
Asshole's head lolled to the side, but as the maser had cauterized the leg wound, there was little blood.
Shauna grabbed the other arm and they tumbled inside, rolling the idiot into one of the last spaces available and sitting on top of him, as there was no other place to go with the closing ramp squashing them together.
"Nobody calls me a bitch."
Shauna sat down on the protester, not making any effort to be gentle.
"You think that's important right now?"
Jesse asked as he safed his rifle and looked for something to hang on to. The pilots had the dropship off the ground and wobbling as it struggled to gain altitude on one engine.
"Oh, this is not good,"
Irene gritted her teeth.
"Colonel, I don't know about this."
The Kristang research base was in a high mountain valley on a planet with a thin atmosphere, and the lowest point of the ridge around them was over 22,000 feet high. If both engines had been healthy, the dropship could have easily made it into orbit, even overloaded as it was. With only a single damaged engine generating less than half its normal peak power, the craft was struggling to climb at all. Ruhar dropships had supplemental booster packs that could be installed under the wings to provide a one-time surge of thrust for heavyweight takeoffs, but none of those packs had been brought down to the planet. Irene would not have brought them into combat anyway, as having volatile booster packs slung under the wings was just asking for trouble in a situation where the dropship had been shot at.
"We're at 18,000 and we can barely maintain that.
Can we circle back, fly a longer route to gain altitude?" Perkins suggested.
"Distance won't help, ma'am."
Irene told herself to be patient with their non-pilot commander.
"It's simple math. We're too heavy for the power available."
She kept the I-told-you-so tone out of her voice, but that wasn't easy.
"Part of the problem is there's a strong wind coming from the direction of the gap we're trying to fly through. It's creating a downdraft on this side of the ridge. That gap is the lowest point on this side of the rim. Next low point is over 1,000 feet higher."
"We don't have time anyway to change course at this point," Derek warned. Perkins debated an idea she hated. She had stubbornly insisted on taking every single person with them, and now her refusal to consider immovable facts might kill them all. In a flash, she remembered allowing her team to stuff lockers full of food packages, and she had not seen MREs among the seats and other gear stripped out of the ship.
"Could we lighten our load?"
"Not at this point, ma'am," Irene explained. "Opening a ramp would spoil our aerodynamics and cause us to drop. By the time we got the ramp closed and climbed, it would be too late."
"I'm sorry. I don't see we have any good options,"
she declared, as her eyes flitted rapidly across the display in front of her. Maybe below them was a canyon or an arm of a mountain they could land behind and shelter from the nuclear shockwave.
"I'm going to try something," Derek announced as he flipped a switch to take command. "My aircraft."
"What are you doing?" Irene's voice was unsteady as a sudden jolt hit the airspace craft. The jolt caused her stomach to do flip-flops. They were dropping.
"The only thing I can think of."
Derek didn't take his eyes off the instruments. With one hand, he was playing with the throttle.
"Not this. Whatever you're doing, it's not working."
"The other thing had no chance," Derek replied evenly.
"I'm watching the fan blade pitch.
You call out the climb rate indicator?" Irene glared at the other pilot but kept one eye on the instruments. Ruhar airspace craft did not have the ability for pilots to manually adjust the pitch of the engine fan blades, a feature both humans found limiting and annoying. Instead, the flight computer set the angle at which the turbine fan blades bit into the air based on speed and power settings. To Irene's amazement, Derek's action of reducing throttle had the effect of deepening the pitch, and she watched fearfully as the altimeter steadied, then began slowly increasing. She sucked in a breath, unwilling to speak lest she jinx their temporary good luck.
"We are climbing."
When the rate of climb reached 700 feet per minute, she announced that fact.
"And now 850 per minute. Rate of increase is slowing, but..."
"Derek, how did you know?"
"Something I read in a book about aviation in World War II when they were still figuring out the principles of aerodynamics. I knew the computer adjusts this ship's blade pitch based on power settings, so I hoped reducing power would drop our airspeed and make the blades take a bigger bite of air to compensate. We did lose airspeed, but we don't give a shit about that now. We're climbing at our best velocity, and that's the best we can do. Are we going to clear the ridge in time?"
Irene ran a quick estimate.
"With 40 seconds to spare at this rate."
"Outstanding." Perkins exhaled in relief behind them. Perhaps her stubbornness had not killed them. This time. That was a lesson she needed to remember. They cleared the ridge, having to battle strong and gusty winds as they approached and flew through the gap. On the other side, Derek dipped the nose and advanced the throttles, trading altitude for airspeed in an effort to put distance between them and the coming shockwave.